So we're going to talk a bit and actually do some practice associated with that harsh critic we all have. Now we talk about that, and it's been mentioned a few times, and so we'll delve into it and have a little more understanding of it over the next little while. But one of the reasons it's so important is not just because it's so painful, is that it's often interferes with their being effective, just in a very simple way. Now, think of it like this. So there are three basic mechanisms that mindfulness cultivates. The first is intentional action. So I form an intention. It doesn't really matter what the intention is. And then I pay attention to the object of intention. Now that's really, really important, because what I'm really doing is cultivating the ability to connect responsively to the ongoing flow of my life. And of course, each time we do that, we recognize how many times we fail at that, because it's extremely hard to do on an ongoing way. I presume that if I sat in on a mountaintop in Tibet for a couple of years, just practicing it, it would come naturally. But for most of us, the natural thing is for our mind to wander. Now the next thing that happens, so it's intention, attention to the object of intention, and then perhaps the most important for all of us, non-judgmental awareness. Now, most of us have grown up in circumstances and in our educational systems. Most things that we do are associated with harsh judgments when we haven't done them the way that we intended to, or was expected of, or we thought we should have. And so why is it so important that we begin to connect to that in a very different way? Well, just bring to mind a task that you've done, and it wasn't quite the way you wanted it to be. And you said the usual stuff to yourself, why can't I get this right? And probably followed up with, why can't I get it right? Why can I never do this? Some version of that. At least that's what I do. So I presume I'm human, and most of you are, so some version of that. And so if you just take a moment to think about where your mind goes when you do that, you'll notice something. It's that while you are spinning into that spiral, we're spinning that spiral down, we are no longer paying attention to the task we were attending to. What we're doing is we're paying attention to who we are that we're creating with our own words, and we've lost contact with what we intended to do. So one of the things you recognize is that when I begin to have this harsh judgment come up, it isn't particularly useful. As a matter of fact, it's often counterproductive, because if I've made an error, and who doesn't, then the thing I want to do is to say, oops, and connect to what I need to do to begin to resolve that error. Not spin away in some random discussion with me about how incompetent I am. Maybe I am, but it's not going to fix the error. So when you begin to think about this as being just something to do, you recognize it's incredibly important. It keeps us connected. When I can look at it with curiosity, and I'm going to say, oops, that's discernment. That's not judgment. That's discernment. That wasn't my best move. And then I stay connected to what I need to do next. When you're a therapist, that happens all the time. you make an intervention and it went south and you said, whoops, I didn't think that was going to do that. And then you take a deep breath and you think of the next thing to say to bring us back. You're writing a report and all of a sudden you recognize that you've left out the paragraph you need and you've got to go all the way back. It really isn't going to help. If you're talking about how often do you do this, why does it always happen, can I pay attention, it means you've got to go back and start. So this harsh critic, that's an evolutionary process, is in fact valuable only if you can give it a different voice. Only if you can give it a different voice. So think for a moment. This is going to be a thought experiment, if you will. And it's, you don't have to voice it. We'll not ask for that, so don't worry about it. And think for a moment about something that, for instance, you'd like to correct in yourself. So when I start writing anything, I may as well out myself so you get some idea of what I'm asking for. When I start writing anything, the first thing that comes up, you don't know enough. What makes you think? The words, I'm sure, you just can't do it. And it's true, that's what I do each time. No matter how many times I write, no matter how many articles I get in a magazine, I'll do it every time. And there's a history to that, I mean, and it really doesn't really matter, but historically, that's been a pattern that I've developed because of some conditions that I grew up with. But what the harsh critic is saying is you're not bright enough. Now for me, the purpose of that, and so I'll give you a bit of context, is to keep me from embarrassing myself. If you don't write it, you won't get embarrassed. So it has this thing it wants to do for me. But ultimately, the way it wants to do it is not terribly useful. So what I ask you to do is think of something like that, that you would like to change, that you've probably been trying to change for millennia or two, just like I have. And you probably may even be frustrated with it, and ask yourself the question, what's it trying to do for me? How is it trying to help? So sit with that for a moment. Try to discern when you're no longer deep in thought. So, perhaps then beginning to think of how the critic, your critic, inner critic, addresses you about this issue. Perhaps it sends by somebody's voice, that's sometimes the case. Perhaps it's your own voice, or perhaps it's a sort of a voice that's kind of like computer generated, it's nobody's voice. And what's the tone? What tone does this voice use? What are the words? What does the voice say to you? Your inner critic's voice. Not always, but in many cases, the tone is harsh, demanding. The words are at the extreme. Never, always. And the question often engages you with an inherent fault you think you have. Why am I like this? Now, if you think of those three conditions, they were extremely useful 35 or 40,000 years ago, when the intent was to motivate us so we can avoid the saber-toothed tiger, the marauding other band of hunter-gatherers. And so the harsh voice activates our survival system, it gets us upregulated, and it prepares us for fight or flight. The extreme makes it appear catastrophic. It makes it appear very, very important. It's like that incessant sound of the fire alarm that drives you crazy when you know there's no fire. But it makes you move because you can't stand to hear it. And the question why has you ruminating. You're going over and over, so it won't let you break free from the actual words. They come back. Why are you? Because to be quite honest, there's no answer to the question why. So if you see this as motivating you to save yourself from an acute stressor, then it's incredibly effective. But I don't want to go past this too fast because I want you to actually sit there and just take that in. We have a system that's meant to help us deal with stress, but is attuned to the stresses we had 40,000 years ago, not to today's. So just give that some thought. So, next part of the thought experience, imagine your friend coming with you with the same issue you are considering yourself. Explaining how distressing it is that this is happening to them. Forgetting Lynette's example of yesterday. So the response typically is not going to be suck it up. Think of the tone you would use for your friend. Bring to mind the tone and bring to mind the reason that you would use that tone. What words would you use? And why would you use those words? What would you be intending? Now, there's a reason why the words you're probably using and conceptualizing, because the way we typically talk to our friends is so they will hear us. So we're not motivating with fear. We're engaging thoughtfully. Concern. Now again, there's an extremely important reason why we do this, and I shared it with one more horse story, so the ones who heard it this morning or this afternoon. You can listen again or just do something else. So if you're trying to teach a horse to actually jump, you'll notice if you've ever watched a horse jump, that some horses gallop with tremendous confidence and go right over. Other horses come to the jump, but they seem as if the rider is having to force the ride. Now, the horse, if it's skilled at it, will still jump and typically clear the jump. But the head is going to be turned away. They're going to almost look like they're avoiding it, as if they've never done it before. Now, there's a good reason for that, because the horses that jump have actually always moved toward being able to do that at their own comfort level. So initially, what happens is they begin to move over trot poles, very small things on the ground where they can really step over. And it gives them some sense of how to lift their feet in order to be able to move over something. And as they become proficient, it's gradually increased, and the complexity is increased. And so at each time, they have learned how to do it, and they actually remember how to do it. And so by the time they're jumping those large jumps, they have learned exactly how to approach it, and the rider simply has to set the horse on a certain path. The other horse, however, has been pushed too fast. So because it does it and it's done out of fear, it never learns. And so it doesn't have the confidence because it never processes the information. So one of the reasons this harsh critic keeps coming up is that it really isn't teaching us anything, because that's not his intent. His intent is to motivate us to get out of danger. But truthfully, what we want our critic to do is to teach us something. And that's really, really important. We want it to teach us something. So think about the example, and think about the critic and the voice, and think about what you want your critic to teach you. Put that in the concept of mindfulness, of being present. Just using that as a template. What would you like your critic to teach you about that moment? And sometimes those answers come more easily, and you may already be there, if instead of asking why, we ask what's happening. What are the causes and conditions that led to this happening? What? Not why. Now we use what as opposed to why, because what keeps us in the present and it engages with what's going on, not who we are. So it takes us out of that ruminative process and puts us into problem solving. What is going on? But remember that what arises in our awareness is associated with causes and conditions. What's going on? And we might also ask, as we're beginning to explore, when does this happen? Perhaps connecting to other instances and beginning to see a pattern that takes it away from what's wrong with me, but connects to me to what's going on and when is it happening. So it's not that we don't want to listen to this critic, it's that we want to give it a compassionate voice. That we'd like it to engage effectively so it can be helpful. Because it's raising something extremely important. That for some reason, I had an intended action, it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. So self-compassion, and this is an act of self-compassion, I'm going to speak to myself in a compassionate voice, honoring the intent of my critic, but allowing me to engage with the critic's intent in a way that's skillful. So we begin to break aside that myth that the only way to get ahead, the only way to do it right, is to be hard on myself. Because this myth, that's the myth we all live by. If I'm not hard on myself, then I'm just not going to get it right. I'm not going to get it done. It's not going to happen. And this doesn't mean that I'm not discerning about what I'm doing. It just means when I'm hard on myself, I step away from what's actually going on. And the fact is, I don't learn from the experience. And so my critic shows up every time I start writing. Who thinks that you have anything to say? And then I engage with that in a particular way. Instead of then beginning to spin into, why can't I? I never should have. I never should have agreed to do this. I don't know why I thought I could. Yada, yada, yada. You can fill in your own blanks. And then I say, thank you. I appreciate your concern. So the nice thing about thoughts is they're not necessarily always facts. They're just thoughts. And the thing about a harsh critic is they tend to be schemas, if you will, templates that are deeply embedded and pop up without really having any consideration. For me, they just pop up because they pop up. So the first thing I do is I recognize it for what it is. But then I also need to understand, it's telling me some things I need to know, which is that this is important. Okay? It wouldn't come up if it wasn't important. It doesn't come up when I'm writing for the fun of writing. It comes up when I'm writing when it's important. So it lets me acknowledge that it's really important, and therefore I better be serious about it. And I can even thank the critic. Sometimes, when I'm feeling just a little playful, I'll say thanks in my head. It doesn't say you're welcome, but anyway. But it says to me, this is something important, so pay particular attention. This matters to you. Or perhaps it matters to patient that I'm writing a report for. It matters. So take it seriously. So when I hear that, it focuses me. I put things aside. I make sure I have all the information I need. It's my guide that this is really important, but I change the language so that it teaches me, and I can remember, that I've done this before. Because the why question keeps me away from that information that I've done it before. It has me ruminating. And it has me ruminating on, why is this always happening? Why am I always getting myself in this position? Why do I promise I'm going to do these things? Why? And of course, that's designed to keep me stop, and not do something that's going to be public that will embarrass me, that I will be ashamed of. Logically, and I've done this for years, and so I know that's not true, but once my intensity arises, the fact that it's not true, is in the background and is not prominent. What's prominent is the sense that I cannot and I don't know how. So, it all slips periodically. It tends to slip when I'm extremely tired. When the particular thing I'm writing is extremely complex, when there's a deadline, that's going to be very hard to meet. When there are conditions that create the stress that exacerbate the harsh critic. So I guess what I'm saying is you're going to have your critic forever. So we may as well start befriending it. Allowing it to show up. And then finding a way to tame it. To give it a sense of being able to connect with us in a way that we can hear it. So it's a conversation with this critic of ours that allows us to acknowledge its importance and its concern for us. It tends to pop up when things are important. It doesn't pop up when it doesn't matter. It tells us it's important, and it tells us to pay attention. And then we can begin to give the critic a voice that allows us to pay attention. Remember, we're using our mind to train our brain. Isn't that kind of neat? Get your head around that one. Because when we begin to do that, then it begins to learn to be quieter. Because we've listened to it. When I try to shut it out, it's like any other thing that's demanding to be heard. It gets louder. When I develop a relationship with it that allows it to be heard, it gently tells us what we need to do. So you're always going to have it. And so really the issue is not getting rid of your harsh critic. It's giving it a voice that makes sense, that's compassionate, that's caring, that informs you that this really matters. Now, what I've just done verbally and you've done silently is a script from Mindful Self-Compassion. So now it's recorded. You don't necessarily have to write it down, but what I would like you to do is once you start listening to the recording, I would like you to write down the exercises. Just so you can see on paper in front of you, which is easier for you to retain, and also if you write it down, it's easier for you to actually take in. The mind will process it in a particular way. All of us know that if we're trying to actually read something and we want to remember it, it's much better if we take notes. So do this as an exercise once you log on to it and got the recording. If by some chance that recording doesn't work, I also have a script for it that I can send you. But the last part of the exercise is that it's really, really important to write a letter to your critic, thanking it for being there trying to help, understanding his intent is to keep you safe, and then making suggestions that you think might help it work better. Again, writing that down begins to record that on your hard drive. And it goes a long way toward being able to bring that critic into a space where you enjoy hearing it, because it actually connects you to something that matters to you, lets you know it's important. And at the same time, gives you a way of looking at yourself that has you recognize what the causes and conditions are that have you a bit stressed about this. Remember, if I'm writing just for fun, it never shows up. If I'm writing because it's important, it's telling me that it's scared I'm not going to do well enough, and it's trying to get me